Our next guest on Downtown had a long career with National Public Radio. He's a University of Maine graduate. And along with our friend Dr. Heather Cox Richardson, we'll be discussing the future of the humanities tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Collins Center at the University of Maine in celebration of the McGillicuddy Humanities Center's first decade. Brian Naylor joining us this afternoon here on Downtown. Hey, Brian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.
So I'm sitting right now in the WZON studio, which many years ago was the WLBZ radio studio. Am I right that this was your first commercial job?
That's right. You may well be sitting in the exact same spot. But I'm not sure exactly when it was, but I know I was there in the summer of 76. It was the bicentennial summer, I remember. And that was my first professional radio job. It was very exciting.
Now, you didn't start at the University of Maine. You transferred there, right?
Yeah, I went to the University of Connecticut for a year, and I was living at home at the time. And I really wanted a college experience that sent me away from home and a place that had journalism and broadcasting, which the University of Connecticut, strangely enough, didn't. And I landed in Maine. It seemed like it would be a great place to go to college, and it was. I don't have a regret. I was on the air, a month or so after I arrived as a transfer student on WMEB, and so it all worked out pretty well.
What do you remember most about your time as an undergrad or working at WMEB?
Well, so I anchored an evening, we called it the Evening Report. It was an evening news program Monday through Friday, and we had a guy who would come in and do the weather, and a guy who did the sports, and it was a lot of fun. It was a great learning experience. I mean, we didn't do a lot of original journalism. We covered a few campus events. Mostly it was the news part of it was from the AP Wire, but it was a chance to, to try to learn the ropes a little bit. And I also was able to do a music show a couple mornings a week. So it was a really good experience. A real hands-on kind of experience for me. And, never having been on the radio before, it was kind of nerve-wracking at first, I guess, but I kind of caught on, and I kind of gradually built up some self-confidence into what I was doing. We covered the local political scene back in the 70s. I remember it was Governor Jim Longley, and there was a Senate race with Senator Muskie, and so we managed to score some interviews with those candidates, got my political feet wet there as well.
Now, what drew you to journalism? Was it one event, or was it just something about the field, the opportunity to maybe travel, that drew you to it as a young man?
Yeah, it was kind of a little of all of that. I grew up watching the news and listening to the news in the 60s and in the early 70s, and it was a time of great tumult, not unlike what we're experiencing now in some ways. There was a war being fought and a lot of demonstrations against the war. There was the civil rights marches. There were assassinations. And then, of course, by the time I was ready to go into college, Watergate. And so I was just always interested in the news and in following it. And I thought that, this was something that I could do. This was something that I wanted to do. I wanted to be a part of bringing these stories to people. And I was kind of blessed, and, I kind of knew from the get-go that this was the direction I wanted to take in my career. And I was fortunate enough to be, I have a decent enough voice on the radio. I have an ability to, write fairly well, at least to get my stories across. And so it was just a real good fit.
Well, you were here at such an interesting time in Maine. You mentioned Governor Longley, the first independent to be elected governor of Maine. Bob Monks, who was ahead of his time as a millionaire running for Senate against Ed Muskie. And I think you were here still covering the Indian land claims case.
That's right. When I after I left WLBZ, I worked out of the State House, a news bureau in the State House for a while. And so that was a real big issue with the Indian land claims case. And it was then Attorney General Brennan, I believe. And so, yeah, that was something that was a big story. And I got a chance to, travel around a little bit. They were talking about building an oil refinery in Eastport or Searsport, somewhere down east. And I remember going up there and covering a town hall meeting on that. And it was great. It was really interesting kind of the challenge to be able to tell these stories in a way that you can. They were understandable and kind of break down these complicated issues in a small news spot. It was a challenge, but it was one I was up for.
We're talking with Brian Naylor here on Downtown, a very long career and productive one at National Public Radio. Why is the mission of NPR so important, perhaps even more important today?
Well, there are so few news outlets, in radio that that you have the time and the opportunity to go in deep and provide in-depth coverage and analysis of an issue, of a story. When I first started there, it was kind of seen as an alternative radio network, kind of leftist and hippie radio, but it changed. It changed rapidly, I think. I had nothing to do with it. But in the 80s, it became much more of a mainstream outlet. People really turned to it as a trusted source of news. We told the story. We told all, not just the right and the left, but all of the shades of gray in the story. And so I think people came to value that. And at the same time, I worked at WLBZ and another station in Maine. There were small stations that did news, but that's not the case anymore. The economics of the business just changed so much. And so NPR was one of the few radio sources that you could turn to. And, so I think, that's part of why it's become such a trusted and valued resource for so many people across the spectrum. I think we have, the polls, I say we, I actually retired from there at the end of February, but NPR has had a pretty good cross-section of political viewpoints among our listeners, and I think that's one of the reasons is because they trust us to tell it straight.
Well, and also offering long-form news that even if you get news on a local station, you're likely to get a 2 or 3 minute newscast, not anything that can go into any level of depth.
That's exactly right. I mean, we do the shorter newscasts at the top of the hour in all of our programs and throughout the day. And there are many stations that carry those and do not carry the longer form magazine shows. But there's no place that really provides, it used to be four minutes. Sometimes you have an opportunity to do something for 8 minutes or a 12-minute segment, which is more and more rare these days. But most of our stories come in around 3 or 4 minutes, and You know, it seems as though that's short, but you can really get a lot of, I mean, it seems as though it's short if you're in commercial radio. It's an eternity, but it's a chance to really get in depth and really tell, get kind of into the weeds a little bit in, on some of these issues.
What was it like as a young reporter getting that assignment to cover the Reagan White House?
Well, it was, you know, it was a thrill. It was like I had to pinch myself when that happened. I had joined NPR as a newscaster, doing those hourly newscasts, but I knew I wanted to be a reporter because I felt that that's what was the real challenge. And so I, you know, kind of wrangled my way into a weekend reporting gig, and then they said, you know, we've got an opening at the White House. Would you be interested in that? And so, yeah, it was a dream come true. And it was a time when the White House was, it was the latter couple of years of the Reagan administration, and it was kind of bogged down then in the Iran-Contra affair.
Right.
And which was an extremely complicated story to tell, but an important one also. I just kind of hit the ground running there. And, you know, to be able to walk through those gates, the Northwest Gate, and into the press room. And, you know, I got to go on some trips with Reagan and went out to Santa Barbara for a couple of weeks when he went out there in the summer. And so it was a real interesting time, and I was so, you know, it seemed like, you know, what the work that I had sort of put in to get to that place had finally had paid off.
Now, you traveled the world in your job with NPR, a number of assignments. I think I read that you'd visited some 40 countries in your travels. Was there one assignment that was the most challenging to you or most powerful as a reporter?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I hit 40 countries, but I hit a number of them. I covered the aftermath of the tsunami in Japan. I guess that was some 10 years ago now. And to see the destruction there was incredibly sad, but the resilience of the people there was very inspiring. A lot of the other assignments I had were I would drop in for a while. I dropped in Jerusalem for a couple of months and covered what was then, you know, the Intifada, which the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis in Jerusalem, which, you know, has never been resolved and always flares up and will, you know, who knows. But it seemingly always will flare up. Got a chance to cover the bureau in London at a time when the Gulf War was going on between when Iraq invaded Kuwait. Got a chance to sort of listen to another country's take on an event like that. And I did a lot of traveling. Most of the traveling I did was within the U.S. covering different political campaigns for the House and for the Senate. And that was, you know, that was really a great experience to see people, you know, the cliche beyond outside the Beltway, talking and being concerned of the issues that affected them and the kind of people that were, trying to address those issues, whether it was taking control of the House for the first time in 40 years in 1994, what the Republicans did, or trying to hold on to power. It's always a really interesting dynamic.
As you travel the country, I'm just wondering if you got the impression that we are as polarized as we seem if we just follow the national news and the big picture.
That's a really tough question, and it's a really important question. I think that The people who are involved in the political sphere certainly are. You know, the base of each party, I think, is really dug in. I think for a lot of Americans, though, it's a question of, you know, politics are not in the front of everyone's mind. It's how do I make a living? How do I put food on the table? How do I, you know, my kids' schools are, you know, are my kids' schools meeting my standards? Are you know, the potholes that need to be repaired down the street being taken care of? I think it's a lot less, you know, polarized in that sense. However, you know, I just drove back from Michigan over these past couple of days, and very intense election going on there, and in Ohio and in Pennsylvania, and there are a lot of lawn signs, and there's a lot of there's a lot of anger out there. I think still, you know, you see lawn signs directed at or banners directed at the president and at the former president, and so there is a lot of polarization. But I think for most people, it's more. There are more serious concerns in front of them in terms of their jobs and raising their families.
You'll be at the Collins Center on Friday discussing the future of the humanities. All this in celebration of the McGillicuddy Humanities Center's first decade. Why? It's a crazy question, but I ask it anyway. Why are the humanities so important?
Well, because they're kind of the backbone, I think, of society in some ways. You know, whether it's the English language or literature or American and world history. I mean, these are important things to know. And the humanities, I think, right now are kind of on the front lines of this polarization that we were talking about, the front lines of the so-called culture war. You know, it's the books that people want to ban and the curricula that they're objecting to in their schools, and the threats on librarians and teachers. Mm. This is all, you know, an example of you know what is going on right now in this country, and the humanities are on the front lines, and I think that we need to understand the importance, and we need to understand that it's important to get a well-rounded education, to be a well-rounded citizen. It's important to get a job, and there are a lot of people who are focused on the STEM sciences, the technology, and engineering. But it's also important to have a well-grounded background in the culture as well.
Well, as someone who taught high school civics and history for more than 30 years, I certainly applaud that. But I also wondered, too, it became for me an increasing challenge to teach those things when we've reached a point in our society where people don't even agree on basic facts anymore.
No, you're absolutely right. And that is troublesome. And what is truth? You know, who is telling the truth? What is the truth? And so I think, you know, that is the challenge that we have in society and that teachers have now, journalists have now. I've always felt that it was really important to provide information to people so that they can make decisions, informed decisions about their political choices, or at least be aware and knowledgeable of what is happening. Happening in their communities and in their states and in Washington. There are real challenges. You know, there is so much disinformation out there. It's so easily it's so easily disseminated on social media And everybody kind of also sort of falls into their own bubble, their own feedback loop, whether it's listening, you know, to NPR or watching Fox News. You know, there is a real division, I think, amongst the media that people consume, and people tend to kind of live in their own bubble, and so that's a real challenge, and I certainly don't have the answers to it, but that's something that we have to deal with as a society right now.
Do you think we're facing a real possibility that whatever happens in the election this fall, that a large number of candidates on the losing end will simply refuse to accept the results?
Well, that's what we're hearing, right? There are candidates, and I have to say they're mostly all Republicans that are saying that if it doesn't go my way, if I don't win, I'm not going to concede and I'm not going to accept the results. You see that in Maryland here, where I live, with the Republican candidate. We see it in a lot of different states. I think Washington Post did a kind of a survey. There were over 200 candidates nationwide for, you know, everything from governor to secretary of state to senator to member of Congress that are, you know, not committing to accepting the results. I mean, part of it is, you know, fine, it's not going to really matter if you don't accept the results. If you don't lose, there's nothing you can do about it. But on the other hand, there are a lot of candidates who are running for office who are saying, you know, the 2020 election was fake, and the results were fake. And if that should happen again on their watch, if they get elected Secretary of State, they're going to do what they can to make sure that their guy wins. And so, yeah, there's a real danger there.
Interesting times indeed. Brian, it's great for us to talk with you. Have enjoyed your work for a number of years. And let me welcome you in advance back to the state of Maine, back to Black Bear Country tomorrow for a discussion of the future of the humanities with Dr. Heather Cox Richardson tomorrow at 3:00 at the Collins Center. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.